Well, I'm sure probably all of you are familiar with the story of Balak and Balaam. And what I found really interesting is this morning during our prayer service, we just happened to be reading from the 23rd chapter of Luke. And it jumped out at me as I was reading through that chapter this morning how Herod and Pilate, who are enemies, became friends when it came to doing away with Yeshua. And the exact same thing happens here with Balak and Balaam, who are from warring peoples. But when it came to wiping out Israel, they had a common enemy, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so they enter into a pact together. And Balak hires Balaam, this prophet, to come and curse Israel. Balaam is an interesting character. He is such a fascinating person. Not a likable person, but fascinating. Daniel Lancaster calls him the patron saint of spiritual pride. The patron saint of spiritual pride. And then, as you know the story, Balak sends a group of men to tell Balaam, I'll pay you all kinds of money if you'll come and curse Israel. So Balaam says, you wait here, I'll go ask God. He goes and asks Elohim, comes back, says, God says no. And they basically offered him more money. He says, let me go ask again. And God says yes. Is God fickle? No, he's not fickle. But you know what? Sometimes when God has told us no, and we do not accept no as an answer, God will say yes. And then we'll wish we had accepted no as the answer. Sometimes God will grant us our request. What does he do? He sends leanness to our souls. And basically, Balaam, because he went back to God a second time, it would eventually cost him his life. Now, God didn't lose any glory from it. He certainly got glory from what Balaam said. But Balaam went down in history as an example of how not to do things. He went down in history as Daniel Lancaster says, the patron saint of spiritual pride. So he saddles his she-donkey, and he goes as Balak's men. Now here's a fascinating passage. As he's riding along on his donkey, it says there in chapter 22, verse 21, says, Balaam arose in the morning, saddled his she-donkey, and went with the officers of Moab. And verse 22, God's wrath flared because he was going. And an angel of the Lord stood on the road to impede him. And in the Hebrew, it's Lestatan. The word Satan is used there, to be an adversary to him. Now, why was it God says no, and then he says yes, and now he's wanting to kill Balaam for accepting the yes answer? I think I have an idea. At first, Balaam went to the Lord. Lord said no. Balaam accepted that as the answer. Goes back. When they double their offer, he goes back to the Lord and really pleads with him, but is still willing to do what God says. And if God says no, he'll accept no as an answer. But God says, okay, go ahead. And I think what happened between the time God said yes to Balaam and the point where Balaam's actually on his donkey and riding, something in Balaam's heart had really turned a corner. It's like, yes, I got my way. Yes, I'm going to get my money. And instead of having a heart of obedience to whatever God wanted, now he says, oh, good, God wants what I want. This is great. You ever done that? God answers a prayer, but then your motives for prayer change? You ever done that? God answers your prayer because your motives are right. And once you get your answer, your motives that you had for that prayer go under a change, and all of a sudden you find broken fellowship with God. So anyways, God sends an angel to kill Balaam. He was riding on his she-donkey, and his two young men were with him. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing on the road with his sword drawn in his hand. So the she-donkey turned away from the road and went into the field. So try to remember what the donkey does. First time the donkey turns away, goes into the field. And says, then Balaam struck the she-donkey to turn it back onto the road. Second encounter. The angel of the Lord stood in the path of the vineyards, a fence on this side and a fence on that side. So going down a lane with stone walls on each side. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and pressed against the wall. And of course, Balaam, since he's straddling the donkey, his leg gets pushed into the wall. It's painful. And so then he continued to strike it. Here's the third encounter. The angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no room to turn right or left. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and crouched beneath Balaam. Balaam's anger flared. He struck the she-donkey with a staff. Now notice the first time the donkey goes into a field. No pain to Balaam. Second time, the donkey runs into a wall. Now Balaam's feeling some physical discomfort. The third time, the donkey just falls straight down. And I'm sure Balaam felt some discomfort, and also his pride was wounded. Because after all, he's trying to impress this group of men from King Balak. This is kind of a course I found when I'm resisting God. God's kind of gentle at first. Things don't go quite my way, but no great loss. But I just kind of redouble my fortitude, my determination, and now I begin to experience some physical pain. God brings some pressure in my life. And a third time, I suffer embarrassment. Have you ever followed, has this ever happened to you, or am I the only one? Because when we resist God, God starts gently. Now the amazing thing about Balaam here is that here he's supposed to be this great seer, yet the donkey can see what Balaam can't see. Yet Balaam in his spiritual pride, skip over to his third blessing. It's supposed to have been a curse, but third blessing. It's over in chapter 24. And listen to how Balaam introduces himself. This is a hoot. It starts in verse 2. Balaam raised his eyes and saw Israel dwelling according to its tribes, and the Spirit of God was upon him. He declaimed his parable and said, "The words of Balaam, son of Beor, the words of the man with the open eye." Oh, yeah? It wasn't as open as the donkeys. "The words of the one who hears the sayings of God." Really? Then why didn't you take no for an answer and leave it at that? "Who sees the vision of Shaddai while fallen and with uncovered eyes." Yeah, right. Now, those are words you could speak about the donkey, but not about Balaam. Now, each of these three occurrences with the donkey corresponds with each of Balaam's three curses. If you look at what happens, what the donkey does, and the failure Balaam has trying to get the donkey to move, you correspond that with the curse he's supposed to have spoken, the blessing comes up instead. You'll see that they line up. You'll see that they line up. It's really interesting. But here's something I want you to look at as well. Who sent the angel to kill Balaam? Who did? God did. But who is the one who opened the donkey's eyes and then allowed the donkey to speak? Because back in chapter 22, in verse 20, it says, "The Lord opened the mouth of the she-donkey, and it said to Balaam, 'What have I done to you that you struck me these three times?' Balaam said to the she-donkey, 'Because you mocked me. If only there were a sword in my hand, I would now have killed you.' The she-donkey said to Balaam, 'Am I not your she-donkey that you have ridden all your life until this day? Have I been accustomed to do such a thing to you?' He said, 'No.' Then the Lord uncovered Balaam's eyes. He saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with his sword drawn in his hand. He bowed his head and prostrated himself in his face. The angel of the Lord said to him, 'For what reason did you strike your she-donkey these three times? Behold, I went out to impede, for you hastened on the road to oppose me. The she-donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Had it not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live.'" So here's the question. Who sent the angel to kill Balaam? God did. Who opened the donkey's eyes and mouth to save Balaam's life? God did. If you didn't know better, you'd say God's working at cross purposes. He sends an angel to kill, sends a donkey to save. And the donkey wins. What is going on here? It's this. The donkey represents Messiah. Humble. Doesn't really talk about itself, doesn't draw attention to itself. It's there to serve and it's there to save. It can see what Balaam could not. It could see danger in the way. And even though it meant it had to suffer to save Balaam's life, it suffered to save Balaam's life. You think, well, that is really put down to compare the Messiah to just a mere donkey. Well, Messiah's humble enough. His humility can take it. In fact, in Psalm 22, Messiah is compared even to a worm. That's how humble he is. He set aside all his repute, all his glory, because he's willing to come to save. Who does the angel of the Lord represent? Messiah. He represents Messiah as well, because eventually Balaam does die by the edge of the sword. And if Balaam had really paid attention to the words of the donkey, he would not have had to die by the sword later on. You see, our Messiah, not being two Messiahs, the way some in Orthodox Judaism they see two Messiahs coming, a Mashiach ben Yosef who comes to suffer and to save, and a Mashiach ben David who comes to conquer and to destroy the enemies. We see there's really one Messiah who comes at two different points in time. And so we see the ministry of the donkey to save and to suffer before we see the ministry of the angel with the sword who comes to kill, to level the playing field. So a wonderful picture, an incredible picture. The New Testament scriptures have some things to say about Balaam. Let's take a look at what the New Testament tells us, because it brings out some very interesting insights. If we turn to 2 Peter chapter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2, we find Peter talking about the last days. In fact, all three of the main passages I'm going to show you are all referring to the last days, the end times. Because through the story of Balaam, God is giving us a glimpse in the kind of warfare and the kind of hindrances, spiritual hindrances, we are going to experience from the likes of people like Balaam. In 2 Peter chapter 2, starting with verse 14. Sounds like everybody's there now. Peter's talking about people in the last days, and he says, having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children, forsaking the right way. Now they knew the right way, but they forsake the right way. They have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a mute donkey, speaking with the voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. This is the way of Balaam. Peter refers to the way of Balaam. What is the way of Balaam? Seeing truth as a means to wealth and power. So you can do this on a small scale. If you're studying the Bible only to impress others, if you're studying the Bible only to win arguments, if you're studying the Bible only because that's the way you get people to pay attention to you, that's the way of Balaam on a small scale. On a big scale, you can turn on a TV program, not all of them, but some programs, where you hear a person proclaiming words of Scripture only for the sake of getting money from you. And we know there's some real shysters out there who have religious programming, and to anyone who knows the Scriptures at all, you only have to listen about 5 minutes to know they are on TV to get your money. That's the bottom line. They don't care about your soul. They care about their pocketbook. This is the way of Balaam. It's alive and well, more so today than at any other time, and it was prophesied to us by Peter. If you back up to the opening verses of this chapter, 2 Peter chapter 2, starting with the first verse, says, but false prophets also arose among the people. These are not people who came in from the outside. They rose up among the people. Just as there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. Many will follow their sensuality, and because of them the way of the truth will be maligned. And in their greed, they will exploit you with false words. Their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. And they're not too difficult to point out. The moment they ask for money, your hackles should rise. Now, I do believe there is a time when we need to put our hand out and say, I have a need. But our hackles should rise. Our antennas should go on high alert, because this is something that the person who practices the way of Balaam always does. He always has his hand out. He always has his hand in your pocket. Be very careful, the one who calls himself a prophet of God and then wants your money. You know, I never could understand these so-called prophets who say, you know what, if you, for every dollar God, you give me, God will give you 10 back. And if you send $1,000, God promises He'll send you 10,000. You know, every time I hear that, I think, then why are you asking me for money? Why don't you give me your money so God can give you 10 times as much back? Doesn't it work both ways? So, anyways. There's another passage I want to look at, or at least you can mark it down. 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul also prophesies about the last days. And in verse 5, listen to what he says. And constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. Did you get that? They believe that godliness, doing God things, doing God's work, is a way of getting rich. He says, now what godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. So anyways, and then that's where he goes down to verse 10. It talks about how the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some longing, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. It amazes me that in these days, in this generation, has arisen a doctrine that teaches that if you truly have faith, you will be rich, you will be wealthy, you will not be sick. And if you do experience sickness, or if you do experience any kind of financial problems, it's because you are in sin. Can you imagine? Only in the modern United States could that doctrine ever find a toehold. I guarantee you it does not find that kind of toehold among the martyrs of China, among the martyrs of Africa, and of other countries of the world where people's faith often costs them their lives. You don't hear about a prosperity doctrine or a name it, claim it doctrine there. Besides the way of Balaam, Jude writes of the error of Balaam. So if you keep on going in your New Testament, if you get to Revelation, just back up a page. Jude is only is only 25 verses long. Give you a moment to find that. Jude. And in verse 11, it says, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam, the error of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. Remember reading about Korah a few weeks ago? And, of course, the story of Cain, who killed his brother Abel, is found in the opening chapters of Genesis. But here he talks about the error of Balaam. What was Balaam's error? What was his error? Well, one of his errors is his inability to perceive God's hand. The donkey could see God's hand. Balaam couldn't. Here's another one of Balaam's errors. He had no fear of God. Now, he saw an angel there with a sword. He feared the sword. He didn't really have a fear of God. Because even after three times of attempting to curse God's people, and he had to hear the words came out of his mouth, that these are God's people, God has blessed them, you can't curse them, that God will curse those who curse them and bless those who bless them, even then, he keeps trying to curse Israel. That's stupid. That's just plain stupid. I'm sorry, the only other way to put it, but that was stupid. And then after he finds all of his curses failing, he calls Balak aside and says, listen, here's a freebie. Let me tell you how you can really get them. This cursing business isn't going to hold any water. It's not going to work. What you do is you take your prettiest girls. You send them in there to entice their young men into idol worship. And then they'll fall. And that worked. And we read about that at the end of our portion and then also in the next week's portion. But he had no fear of God whatsoever. And we do find out later that Balaam did die by the edge of the sword. He was killed by the people of Israel. If he left them alone, he would have been all right. Now let's back up a little bit in Jude 11. Because if you go back to verse 10 in the book of Jude, it says that these men revile the things which they do not understand. Now, a person who has fear of God realizes, I don't understand everything God's written. I don't understand everything about God. I'm not going to mock him. But here's a person, because he does not understand the ways of God, he mocks them. And the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are destroyed. Woe to them. They have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the air of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. These are the men who are hidden reefs in your love feast. I want to go over that phrase a moment. I don't know how many of you are sailors, but a hidden reef is a growth of either rocks or either a growth of coral just right under the water surface. So when you're sailing along, you can't see it. But as soon as you get up to it, it crashes into your hull and tears up your boat and you shipwreck. This has happened thousands of times to sailors over the years. He says, these are hidden reefs. They're hidden dangers. And where are they? In your love feast. What's a love feast? What does the New Testament mean by love feast? It means what we do after our teaching every Shabbat. It's our onig. After we have our prayer and worship up here, after we have our time of study, then we go down to fellowship and we eat together. And it says, these are people who are hidden reefs in those times of fellowship. Be cautious, be careful when someone during the time of fellowship gets you aside, begins to talk about things, and something in your heart begins to turn, and you think, something seems wrong here. Your spiritual radar goes off. And you think, what this person is telling me does not sound like the kind of teaching that goes forth in this place. This does not sound like the elders of Beth Tikun. This does not sound like the spirit of this people. Something's dissonant here. Be careful. Be wary. Because the enemy will always, I don't have, by the way, I'm not looking at her thinking, oh, you know, it's Louis or it's Dale over here. Watch this Dale character. He's a hidden reef. I don't have anybody in mind, okay? I can honestly say, as God's my witness, I can look over our congregation. There's not one of you I perceive as a hidden reef. But I'd rather warn you before a hidden reef comes in than to do it after the fact, okay? So I just want to make sure you're not looking around thinking, all right, who's the hidden reef Grant's referring to? Says, caring for themselves. They don't care for you. They care only for themselves. They're clouds without water. You see, in the Middle East, rain is good. And when you see a cloud coming over the horizon, you're hoping that rain comes over your land and lets, that cloud comes over your land and lets some rain out. But when the cloud just passes by and there's no rain, it's an empty promise. It's an empty hope. These people are like clouds without water. They're like empty hopes. They promise much and do little. Carried along by winds. Autumn trees, what do you expect to see in autumn trees? Fruit, right? But these are autumn trees without fruit. Doubly dead, uprooted. In other words, all show, no go. All talk, no results. Wild waves of the sea, casting up their own shame like foam. Wandering stars, for whom the black darkness has been reserved forever. Interesting, isn't it? This is the error of Balaam. But then in Revelation, we encounter the teaching of Balaam, the doctrine of Balaam. Revelation chapter 2. Here Messiah himself is giving us a warning about the last days. So doctrine, now word doctrine, the New Testament word for doctrine means teaching. So you see the word doctrine in the Bible, it means teaching. Either the teaching you give forth or the teaching you receive. And it says in Revelation 2:14, but I have a few things against you because you have there some who hold the teaching of who? Balaam. Who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. This is the teaching of Balaam. The teaching of Balaam is always sensual. In other words, it always appeals to the flesh. The teaching of Balaam always appeals to the flesh. It never appeals to your sense of honor. It never appeals to your sense of truth, of duty, of obedience, of self-sacrifice. It always appeals to your fleshly appetites. Now, sometimes this appetite, this appeal, can be masqueraded in discipline. What if someone were to come in here in Beth Coombs on Saturday morning and they're decked out in their prayer shawl and they have tefillin on and they have a big furry hat and black coat and all these trappings, but inside they're not Jewish, they're not sincere, they're not really people of love, they're people of look at me. And they'll put on a show of discipline, they'll put on a show of commitment, a show of orthodoxy, when really it's all about them, it's not about God. It's not about convictions. It's about look at me. Now that's never happened here, probably never will. But I'm just giving you an example. So a lot of times this fleshly appetite can masquerade as self-discipline, as self-denial. It's like the person who boasts about his humility. Okay? These people indulge sensuality. They forsake the Torah. An interesting thing. We don't know for sure what the doctrine of the Nicolaitans was. But in verse 15, Yeshua says, so you also have some who in the same way hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Nico is the word we get the word Nike, the Greek word, like the Nike running shoe. Nike means victory. And Laitan is where we get the word laity, people, victory to the people. Or victory over the people. Could be either way. And we don't know too much about what the doctrine of the Nicolaitans was. They're only mentioned twice in the Bible. But one of the things it seems to be is that they were some of the early people who started teaching believers in Messiah to turn away from Torah, that it no longer applies to them. We do know that this is something that Balaam taught. He supposedly spoke for God, but he did not obey Torah at all. And he taught Balak how to get Israel not to obey the Torah. So, whether that was their primary teaching or not, it is one of the things that is suggested that is the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. In 1 Timothy 4:16, Paul tells Timothy, he says, give heed to your life and doctrine. Give heed, or pay attention to, your life and doctrine. And the word there in Greek is the doctrine, the teaching. And that's kind of been in my mind this week because, you know, it's easy to give heed to one or the other. Now, when you see someone whose teaching is righteous and good and true and agrees with Scripture, and you look at their life and they live a life of righteousness and of humility and of purity and devotion, putting others first, love of God, love their neighbor. There's no confusion because the teaching and the life go together. They're one. When you see someone whose teaching is all wrong, their doctrine is trash, and their lives are lives of selfishness and unrighteousness and bitterness and gossip, there's no confusion there because their teaching is wrong, their life is wrong, no confusion. The confusion comes in when someone's teaching is correct and their life is wrong. I've been there. And I regret so many times I could teach a Bible study, look back, and the words were right, but the heart attitude was wrong. And then I could go home and then, you know, just kick back and watch mindless television or just, you know, just cheat on my income tax. I never cheat on my income tax, I know of, but just do that sort of thing. Just be greedy. Just be self-centered. and my life is not in balance with my teaching. On the other hand, there are some people, and we were talking about this with Louis last night. We were talking about a friend of his whose doctrine is really all wrong. His doctrine is washed up. He's part of not a church, but part of a cult, actually. But a great person, a righteous person, a person who loves God, loves his neighbor. He's generous. He's got all the qualities of a mature person. That's kind of confusing. Here's truly a righteous man whose doctrine is pretty fuzzy. And that's kind of confusing. We need to give heed to both. And so when we come to the story of Balaam, we see one whose words of prophecy were right on the money, four times in a row. Yet his life is altogether wrong. And that can be so confusing. And these passages we've looked at from the New Testament are prophecies that in the last days, more of this kind of confusion will come along. People whose words can be right and their lives can be dead wrong. And he says, don't be confused. I warned you ahead of time. And this is called the way of Balaam, the error of Balaam, and the teaching of Balaam. Well, let's get back to our Torah portion. I was real hesitant to share with you this next bit because there's so much room for misunderstanding. But I just really feel it's something worth sharing that if you just focus here and don't take this a direction that was not intended to go, and don't misapply it to things and to people, I think it can bring a lot of understanding and get rid of a lot of confusion. Balaam three times went to curse Israel, but three times blessed them. And then he gives Balak a fourth. He gives him a freebie because Balaam says, I'm not going to pay you. I hired you to curse these people. You didn't curse them. You blessed them instead. So I'm not going to pay you. So Balaam goes ahead. This is chapter 24, verse 12. Balaam said to Balak, did I not speak to your emissaries whom you sent to me, saying, if Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot transgress the word of the Lord to do good or bad on my own. Whatever the Lord speaks, that shall I speak. And now, behold, I go to my people. Come, I shall advise you what this people will do to your people in the end of days. And then Balaam goes on to prophesy and say, here's what Israel is going to do to you. Here is the program of Israel. And he begins to mention various nations. They'll be part of Israel's history long before those nations came on the scene. And one of those nations that he refers to is the nation of Rome. Because when you come down to verse 24, it says, big ships from the coast of Kittim. Kittim is Italy. This is referring to the Roman Empire. Will afflict Assyria and afflict Eber. Eber is where we get the word Hebrew. But it too will be forever destroyed. Then Balaam rose up and went, returned to his place, and Balak also went on his way. So he prophesies the various kinds of nations that will arise against Israel. And he gives some very detailed, very pointed prophecies about these, and he goes up as far as the kingdom of Rome, and he stops there and goes no further. The Jews refer to the exile that they are in now as the Roman exile, because it began 2,000 years ago when Rome ruled the world, and it continues today. And in the book of Revelation, and we just looked at some passages from there, Revelation in chapters 17 and 18 give very detailed prophecies about the fall of Rome, which is still future. You may think, well, wait a minute, Rome is no big deal. Well, when we look at Rome, we're not talking about necessarily just a city. We're not talking just necessarily about a governmental system. We're looking at a spirit that lies behind a city, a governmental system. God looks at the hidden things. Man looks at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart. And when he talks about Rome, he's talking about the very heart of what drove the Roman Empire in ancient years, what will drive the Roman Empire, what we see arising today with the strength of Europe coming up. And Europe is getting up on its hind legs, beginning to stand against the United States and against Israel. It's coming into its own again. And God's describing the heart of this. Now, I want to share something with you that I discovered in a book I read just this last winter. It's called World Storm. It's by Rabbi Roy Neuberger. It's a brand new book. He wrote it after the 9-1-1 disaster in New York. And Roy Neuberger is an Orthodox Jew, a very scholarly man, very familiar with Talmud and Torah. And he brings out one of the most fascinating things I've ever read. In fact, last Saturday at Jocelyn and Kyle's wedding reception, I was sitting with George and Anya and Joan and Dale. We got to talking about this, and they seemed interested enough. I thought, I'll just share it with all of you and go into more detail. We need a little history lesson, though. We all know that Abraham, called by God out of the land of Ur, he was promised a son. They waited, waited, waited. No son came along. So Abram's wife, Sarah, gets a brilliant idea. Take my Egyptian handmaid, Hagar. You can have relations with her. She will hopefully have a child. We'll raise this child as our own. And Abraham says, okay. And out of that union, Ishmael was born. Now, Ishmael had Abram for father. It really wasn't Abraham. It was Abram. This is before Abraham received the hay from God into his name. It's before he was blessed by Melchizedek. It's before the blood covenant was entered into here. I believe it was before the blood covenant. Double check me on that. But anyways, Abram was the father of Ishmael, and Hagar, the Egyptian handmaid, was Ishmael's mother. Ishmael became the father of all the Arab nations. All the Arab nations descend from Ishmael. Not Egypt. Egypt predates Ishmael. But the other Arab nations and the religion of Islam comes through Ishmael. Now, the scriptures have some really interesting things to say about Ishmael. Not flattering things, but interesting. Let's go to Genesis chapter 16 for a moment and see if this does not describe the kind of terrorist we read about in the newspapers every day. Genesis chapter 16. The angel of the Lord comes and speaks to Hagar and tells her a bit about her son. Verse 11. The angel of the Lord said to her further, "Behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man." You think of a wild donkey, you think of something stubborn, willful, wants to kick, wants to make a lot of noise, something that's difficult to tame. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone. This is the thing I find fascinating about the terrorism that comes from fanatical Islam. They're against the Christian, they're against the Jew, they're against everything in between, and they don't even mind blowing up their own people. In the 9-1-1 disaster, there were a lot of Arabs, there were a lot of Muslims in those two towers, but the terrorists didn't care. That's collateral damage. And on top of it all, they'll blow themselves up as well, and that's fine. Their hand is against everyone. Everyone. And all I got to say is when you hear any politician or your neighbor or anyone else say, well, we need to negotiate with them, that person is a fool. Period. Maybe they're a fool by choice. Maybe they're just foolish because they're uninformed. But that is pure, unadulterated foolishness. You cannot make a peace pact. You cannot negotiate with the descendants of Ishmael who are a part of this wicked, satanic religion of Islam. Can't happen. He'll be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live to the east of all his brothers. We can read a bit more about him because later on in chapter 21, Abraham and Sarah have a son of their own, and that son is Isaac. Now, when Isaac comes along, Ishmael begins to mock him. Now, remember, all the Jews are descended from Isaac. Abraham's the father. Abraham had the son Isaac, and all the Jewish people come from Isaac. And so Ishmael's mockery of Isaac is something that's been going on for the last several thousand years. In chapter 21, we'll go down to verse 8. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, this is Ishmael, mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." If you're going down to verse 17, just to cut it short, Abraham goes ahead and lets Hagar and Ishmael go, and they go into the desert, and they run out of water and food, and Hagar and Ishmael kind of give up. But it says in verse 17, God heard the lad crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him." Then God opened her eyes and saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. When you know, each year, is it Ramadan, when the Muslims all make their pilgrimage back, it's called a Hajj, I believe, they go back to Mecca. Well, they built a building over this area where Hagar supposedly heard the angel, and the place where she walked and got the water, they built a long building there, and they walked this long hallway between the place she had the vision and the place where she found the water. And you can go there, well, you can't. Only an Arab can go there, a Muslim. But you go on down verse 20. God was with the lad, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer. So he's skillful in weapons. He's a killer. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So there we get another little glimpse into this people of Ishmael. And Ishmael has always been an enemy of Israel. But let's go a bit further in our story. Isaac has a son. His name is Jacob. And you know the story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau, I dropped a pin on the floor, so if I switch from blue to green, nobody will mind, I hope. But we find that Jacob and Esau are twins. Now, you must keep something in mind. Ishmael and Isaac are brothers, but they're half-brothers. And Ishmael is considerably older than Isaac. Ishmael had a different mother from Isaac. And even Ishmael's father was Abram, not Abraham. It's before Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek, before Abraham received God's breath, breathed into him to change Abram to Abraham. But now Jacob and Esau, this is different. They have the same father, the same mother. They are twin brothers. They share the womb together. Their natures are completely different, but their relationship is much closer. Let's read a little bit, have a little review about Esau. Go to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. And we'll pick it up in verse 23. Now Rebekah is about to give birth, and things are not right. There are problems here. There's a turmoil in her womb, and she cries out to the Lord. Verse 23, the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." And then it says that when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red. That's the word Edom. Esau's name is also Edom, which means red. We discussed this word a little bit last week, I believe. All over like a hairy garment. Hairy always refers to the animal nature. Very physical. Very earthly. Very animal-oriented. The animal appetites are strong in this one. And they named him Esau, which really is Hebrew for hairy. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding onto Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, look at this. Esau became a skillful hunter. Once again, he's a killer, a hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Edom is the other great enemy of Israel. And the reason I went through this little history review is so that you could see that Israel has two great enemies. Edom on the one hand, and Ishmael on the other. Edom is the father of the Roman Empire. The founders of Rome descended from Edom. And Rome has been an enemy of Israel from day one. Ishmael is the father of the Muslim nations. Now from the founding of Islam back in around 7th century, they have been an enemy of Israel. What's interesting, Edom and Ishmael have been enemies of each other. Rome and Islam have fought each other ever since Islam came on the scene. But they both shared a common enemy, and that was Israel. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. I want you to follow this now. Edom settled to the north and west of Israel in the area of Europe. But just as we read in Genesis, Ishmael settled to the east and to the south, area of Arabia. Rome, Edom, have always been people of the sun. People of the sun, S-U-N, not S-O-N. People of the sun. They worship on Sunday, the first day of the week. They are very, very, very materialistic to a fault. Their calendar is a solar calendar based entirely upon the movement of the earth and the sun. On the other hand, Ishmael, his people are people of the moon, people of the night. And like the moon, historically they have waxed and waned. They become great. Planet. Their calendar is a lunar calendar. Their feasts and their times are all based entirely upon the moon. In fact, the symbol for Islam is what? A crescent moon. Israel, on the other hand, is it a lunar calendar or a solar calendar? It's a mixture of both, the perfect balance of both. Their months are determined according to the moon. A month begins on a new moon, but their year is based on the sun. It's a perfect blend. It's a very complex calendar, but a very accurate one, with a blend of the two. Rome is material to a fault. These are people of great empires, great armies, great industry, technology, building roads. I remember in England, the only straight roads you ever found when we lived in England, the only straight ones were the old ancient Roman roads they'd paved over. You could look at a map, it looked like spaghetti dropped out of a plane, and then you'd see straight roads from this town, zip, straight to that town. And you look at the footnote, it's an ancient Roman road, and we love taking those. They were straight and narrow. They even have dips and hills. They went straight, you know, left and right and straight this way. They didn't go uphill and downhill. They would cut the hills away, they'd fill in the valleys. They were straight, smooth roads, 2,000 years old, the best roads in England. The Romans are great builders, great technologists, great scientist. On the other hand, Ishmael was spiritual to a fault. And by spiritual, I don't mean that in a good sense. There are people who meditated upon philosophy, upon religion. And in fact, when you look at the radical Muslims, what is their motivation for what they do, the radical terrorist? So that when they die as a martyr, they will what? They'll receive some kind of heavenly glory with Allah and these virgins assigned to them. They're doing everything for spiritual reasons. Even their hatred of Israel and of the West is spiritual. It's a very sick and twisted spiritual understanding. Just as the sun is something that rules the day and the moon rules the night, you find that Rome has worshipped the god of wood and Islam has worshipped the god of stone. If you read anything at all about the Hajj that the Muslims make once a year to Mecca, in Mecca, there's a black square tent, and in that tent, there's a stone. And the Muslims will circle, what was the thing called, the Kaaba or something, or I forget which is what it's called, they'll circle it seven times, and they'll go and they'll kiss the stone, because it's the stone that fell from heaven, and supposedly Abraham did some kind of sacrifice on it, or some kind of foolishness. But they worship a god of stone. Now here's where I want to be very careful. Rome also has its religion. It's not biblical Christianity, but it's Christendom, which bears little relationship to scriptural Christianity. I'm going to be very careful how I put this. In Revelation, God gives us some very pointed descriptions of the religion of Rome. And when we look at ancient Rome and Romish religion, what it did, it took in and absorbed much of the teaching of Christianity, perverted it, married it to its paganism to where it became something quite different from what we read about in our New Testaments. Quite different. As I've shared with Jewish friends, we begin to talk about the history of the church. I share with them, no true Christian has ever persecuted the Jewish brother. Never. But who have been the two greatest persecutors of Israel? Rome, in the name of the Holy Roman Church, and Islam. You follow me? When Rabbi Neumeier refers to Rome worshiping a god of wood, he's referring to the cross. Now, we're going to be careful here as well. The scriptures talk about the cross, but in Rome, it's not the truth of the cross that's worshipped, it's the physical shape of the cross that's worshipped. Remember last week we talked about the brass serpent that was put up on a pole, and when the people looked at this brass serpent, they were healed? And how Yeshua himself says, unless I'm lifted up, just the way Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so I must be lifted up. Right? And that brass serpent is a picture of Messiah at his crucifixion. But you know, the story of the brass serpent doesn't end in the book of Numbers. It ends in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 18. You can write the reference down. In 2 Kings 18, it talks about Hezekiah, who was a righteous and godly king of Judah, and he goes around destroying all the places of idol worship through Israel. Listen to this, in verse 4, 2 Kings 18:4. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherahs. Listen to this. This is amazing. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the sons of Israel burned incense to it. And it was called Nakhushtan. Nakash, remember, means serpent. They had begun to worship the brass serpent itself. They had moved from the truth that that serpent painted to where they began to idolize the physicality of the serpent itself. You know, the cross, I love the cross because it is a picture of selflessness. It pictures selflessness and how a Messiah set aside his glory. And he became a person of no reputation. He set aside all of his rights, and he died out of love for you and me. That's the truth of the cross. That's an eternal principle. But when you replace the truth of the cross with a piece of wood nailed to the wall, and you worship that, you've done the exact same thing that Israel did with the brass serpent. What was once a thing to represent the truth of God's mercy and grace and bringing healing to his people now became an object of idol worship. You see the subtle difference? The same brass serpent, but the motives of the hearts have become idolatrous instead of obedient. And so that T shape can be a reminder of the truth of what God did through his Son, through the Messiah. Or it becomes an object of idolatry. One is truth and goodness, the other is the worst sort of sin. That's why I have no crosses in my house. We have none, zero. I don't need a T-shape nailed to my wall to remind me of the truth of what God did. I can read the scriptures and read. It's constantly in my mind what the principle of the cross is. It's a spiritual thing. It belongs in my spirit. It does not belong on my wall. You understand what I'm saying? Because the moment it goes on my wall, it's coming that much closer to being an object of idolatry. I don't need that. I don't need that. I have too much problem making an idol of my lovely truck parked out there in the pastor's space. You all know that's a joke. Okay. What does a wood need to grow? It needs the sun. What does a rock need? Nothing. A rock thrives in darkness. Wood needs the sun. One of the things that Constantine did, the Roman emperor back in the 4th century, when he took the truths of Christianity and merged them with the paganism, the ancient religious rites to create Roman Catholicism, he changed the day of worship from the Shabbat to the first day of the week, the Sunday when the pagan god is worshipped. Now, Ishmael worships on the 6th day. Israel worships on the 7th day. And what we see here is the order. Rome rules first. Islam will rule second. The Vilna Gaon, the genius of Vilna, about 150 years ago, as he studied the scriptures, he says, our Roman exile is about to come to an end, and it will be replaced by the exile of Ishmael. He prophesied 150 years ago when the Arab nations were just camel jockeys, before oil was discovered, before they had any money, before they were really just nomads out in the desert, he prophesied that there was a great exile of Ishmael coming, when Ishmael would rule the world. And the Vilna Gaon died, I think, over 100 years ago, well over 100 years ago. Never lived to see one iota of his prophecy come to pass. But look where we're at today. It's astounding, isn't it? Really is astounding. When Rome conquered Israel 2,000 years ago and dispersed them, Israel broke into two cultures. Some went to live in Europe. These were the Ashkenazic Jews. They developed their own traditions, their own type of Hebrew lettering, their own prayer book. And then others went and lived in the Arabic nations, these are Sephardic Jews. And they developed their own customs, which are slightly different. Their own accent, their own Hebrew lettering. In fact, our Torah scroll is a Sephardic Torah scroll. We got it from Germany. How a Sephardic scroll got to Germany, I don't know. But the printing is a Sephardic type printing. And the reason I bring this up is because when you look at this, we begin to see God's plan a bit. And it started all the way back in Genesis with the birth of Ishmael and the birth of Edom. But let's not forget something here. Who's most closely related, Israel and Ishmael, or Israel and Esau? Yeah. These are very closely related. They are twin brothers. And if you recall, as you go back to the story of Genesis, Jacob gets the birthright and the blessing from Esau, and Esau says, I'm going to kill you. And Jacob leaves and they split. So when they started off, they were mortal enemies. But what happens at the end of the story? They come back together and they become brothers again in embrace. And Esau received tremendous blessing because Jacob gives him his flocks, his herd, his cattle, all these possessions, and that's the way it's always been. Christendom has received its blessings from Israel. And we do worship the same God, but Ishmael does not. Don't let anyone ever tell you that Allah is just another name for God. Allah is the name of a demon,
That's why in the early days of Muhammad, they're wondering, why in the world are you referring to the Almighty as Allah? Allah is a moon god. You ready for that? A moon demon. That's what it says in the histories. We do worship the same God, but in different ways. But there is a day coming when Edom and Israel will embrace and become brothers again. By the way, you notice Jacob's ladder here? I put it up here between how Edom is materially oriented and how Ishmael is spiritually oriented. By spiritual, once again, I'm not talking about healthy, mature spirituality. I'm talking about a twisted worship of the unseen realm, but the dark realm. Jacob's ladder. Recall Jacob's ladder was firmly planted on the earth, but its top reached to heaven. This is a picture of what scriptural Judaism is. It has a very material component. It very much embraces this world and everything that has to do with life and food. You know, choose life, living life to the fullest. Being the best you can be at what you do, whether it's working, whether it's reading, whether it's fixing cars or building buildings. You do everything you can with the best skills you have. You enjoy the foods God's given us to enjoy. You make every moment count in this world. You live life to the fullest. But the top of the ladder is in heaven. Their heads are in heaven. And they're looking forward to the Olam Haba, the kingdom to come, the world to come. They bring the two together. This is what's called Tikkun Olam, the repair of the world. Taking this rift between the physical and spiritual and bringing them into one. Whereas in Rome, only the earthly is truly embraced. Whereas here in Islam, only the spiritual is truly embraced. In Judaism, we see the two braced in a healthy, healthy relationship. There's a story in the Talmud. It's a legend. Of course, it's not true, but it's an illustration of truth. It says that in the creation, when God created the sun and the moon, they were of the same brightness. And then the moon came to God and complained. It says, how could two kings share the same crown? And God says, you're right. I'll dim you way down. And I'll make you full and make you wax and then make you wane and almost disappear and then wax again. And now I'll take you so that way the sun can wear the crown. And that's what happened. Now that was written more than 2,000 years ago, long before Islam came on the scene. But what we see here is in the Talmud, in this legend where the moon and the sun are at war with each other, we see that has really become an illustration for history and the relationship between Rome and Islam, between Roman Catholicism. By the way, there are any other religions in the world. These are the only two religions in the world that have tried to conquer the world through brute force. There are no other religions that have tried to do this. Conquer the world through brute force, and Israel gets caught in the middle. There are no other two. Isn't that fascinating? Please don't take what I'm saying and misconstrue it. And here's some of the ways the enemy will want to take the truths I've shared with you and have you misuse them. First of all, to think Catholics are bad people. You know, I may not like the system of Catholicism. I may be able to look back and see what a bloody religion this has been. But some of the finest and best people I know are in the Catholic Church, and many of you were in the Catholic Church, and there's enough truth there giving you hungry for more truth, and you've grown and matured. And so don't hear me speak against Catholics, not at all. The system is totally apostate, but the people are sincere and wonderful and good people, many of them, most of them. We talked earlier about how you should give heed to your life and doctrine. You know there are people in Catholicism who are better people than me. Though my doctrine's better, I won't make any bones about that. I know righteous people in Catholicism who are better people than me, and I hope someday I'll be as righteous and good a person as they are. And you know what? I'd be surprised, but only a little, to find out that there are probably Muslim people who may be more honest, more forthright, and live more righteous lives than you or I do, even though doctrine could not be worse. And I've met a few Muslims who are fine and good people. Maybe they're good people because they're not good Muslims. I don't know. But once again, separate the person from the system in which they are entrapped. Separate the person from the system. When you see someone caught in a trap, do you go and you try to saw the trap in half, or you try to saw them in half? Attack the problem. Don't attack the person. Don't hear me saying when I talk about Edom that I'm referring to true biblical Christianity, which really is indiscernible from true biblical Judaism. I'm not talking about true Christianity. As I want to emphasize again, no true Christian has ever harmed a Jew. Never, ever. But there's so many things been done in the name of Christendom, so awful, that the scriptures refer to this as a harlot, or scarlet whore. And red has always been the color. That's what Edom means, red. Who's drunk on the blood of the martyrs. She rides a scarlet beast. And the Revelation describes its great destruction. You know, with Islam trying to get its hands on nuclear weapons, it would not surprise me. And I'm not prophesying here. Well, I'm just saying, as I look at Scripture, as I look what the rabbis have prophesied based on the writings in the Torah and the things I've shared with you, as Revelation describes the fall of this system here, of Edom, it talks about how it's a tremendous fall. It's very rapid, and it has to do with fire. And it makes you wonder if this is not giving us a glimpse of how Islam comes on the rise. Now, Islam's rule will be very, very short. Very short. But it just makes you wonder a little bit. Now, I'm not trying to strike fear in anybody's heart. Just sharing my thoughts with you. Just sharing my thoughts, trying to make sense out of the current events a little bit. And I hope this is helpful, but please don't misconstrue anything I'm saying here. Don't use this to attack anybody. You know, if you want to attack some system, some wrong system, hey, that's free game. But don't attack people with this. I saw a few hands popping up here. I forget who had hands up first. Phil, I think you had your hand up first. Yes, because he was a son of Abram.
Right. Knowing where that was going to go.
Yes.
And the person was with him. And yet, you see the system that came out of that.
Yes.
Fully knowing what was going to happen. And see
right.
The Roman Empire came out of, you know, Esau.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, you see a balance on that. But there is balance on either side, and yet, if you see that on the center.
Yes. Right. Well, you. Yes. Well, you really put your finger right on what my heart was for sharing this lesson with you, to comfort you. Because it looks like it's all chaos, and you look at scriptures. Where is this in scripture? All this stuff that's going on. It's there. God had it all figured out way back in Genesis. And you can take comfort because God's on his throne. He's not confused. He's not, you know, going, oy vey, what do I do now? He's not doing that. It's all foreseen. And we can really take comfort. And that's what I want you to be, is comforted by this. Don't use this as fuel to attack people. Then you're doing the same thing that Edom and Ishmael do. Attack. That's not Israel's modus operandi. Our modus operandi is to stand like Jacob's ladder. Stand. Stand. That's what we're to do. And be strong. But thanks. There, you put in words very well just what my motives were for sharing this. Yes, Jennifer.
I find it interesting that your translation says she donkey, remind me that NXT means donkey. Mm-hmm. In the NXT, sheep backwards. A she donkey or a gent, they call them genetics.
Yeah.
If you want to protect a flock, a flock of sheep, not hundreds and hundreds of sheep, but you have 50, 60 sheep, and you want to protect them from coyotes and other such predators, one of the best guardians of the flock is a she donkey.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking when we were talking about the end is that if we look historically, look at France today. France is a policy of assimilation with their North African colonies. They're now at a crossroads where they're 50%
and
50% Edom. And now there comes to a point where anti-Semitism is at its worst
in
French history.
You're absolutely right. England is growing that way very quickly. The Islam is just taking over the country there.
Yeah.
So we probably see the same thing happen there in years to come.
Yeah, the last person going there is basically sitting down in the mosque.
Yeah.
Get some type of
fireball. Amazing.
Or
yeah. Referring back to the use of the word, oh my goodness, we really have gone over. Word donkey. Donkey is kamor in Hebrew. The word used here is the word aton. Atone. And it ends in that letter nun that Ted was talking about. The word for she-donkey ends the letter nun, but when nun comes to the end of a word, it's not bent anymore like a humble letter. It stands straight and tall when it comes to the end of a word. So just harkening back to Ted's insights this morning during the Torah service. And it's named an atone because there's a verb which means to take very short steps. And I guess a she-donkey takes real short, cautious little steps. That's a good way to walk. Walk humbly.
I need to make a correction to a statement that was made earlier concerning the birth of Ishmael. I'd incorrectly stated that he was born before Melchizedek had blessed Abraham. Actually, it was after Melchizedek had blessed Abraham. What I meant to say was before Abraham's name change and before Abraham's circumcision, which represents that changed identity, that basic change in life. And after those things, then the promised son, Isaac, was born. So I just wanted to make that correction before these tapes were mailed out.
To our government, to our job, but our security should be found only in you, because you are coming to establish a kingdom that will never be shaken, that will rule for eternity. Lord, it's that kingdom and that king whom we serve. Help us to be found faithful in this, we ask, in Yeshua's name. Amen. And you're dismissed.